This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Patrick Buchanan describes himself as a populist conservative. He says that conservatives have lost their way. His new book, How the Right Went Wrong, is about, quote, how it came to be that a Republican-controlled capital city, whose leaders daily profess their conservatism, could preside over the largest fiscal and trade deficits in our history and have us mired in a Wilsonian imperial war to remake the Arab Middle East in the image of the American Middle West, unquote. Buchanan ran in the Republican presidential primaries twice, and in 2000 was the Reform Party's presidential candidate. He's been an advisor to three presidents and is a longtime political commentator. He's currently with MSNBC. He also edits the new magazine, The American Conservative. You write in your new book, a crunch is coming and a civil war is going to break out inside the Republican Party, along the old trench lines of the Goldwater-Rockefeller wars of the 60s, a war for the heart and soul and future of the party for the new century. Where's the dividing line there?
I think there are four issues on which the Republicans are deeply divided. First is fiscal policy, where the president has run up an enormous amount of domestic social spending in a time of war, which is unprecedented, and failed to veto a single bill. If there's one thing that unites conservatism and conservatives, it is the idea of balanced budgets and small government. And the president has been a big government conservative, as defined by the Weekly Standard. Second would be his failure to defend America's borders from an illegal invasion of millions of aliens from Mexico every year, and his offer of amnesty. A third, I believe, will be trade policies. The president's endorsement of NAFTA, GATT, and the Free Trade Association of the Americas. Many conservatives object to them because they believe these trade deals are responsible for the loss of 2.7 million manufacturing jobs since Mr. Bush took office. He has lost one in every six manufacturing jobs in this country since he took office. Now, while the Republican Party is free trade today, historically it has been a party of economic nationalism or economic patriotism that argued that the industrialization of America was vital and that we should have the highest standard of living in the world. And many of the many wage earners have seen their wages fall because these good manufacturing jobs have gone abroad, as well as now white-collar jobs are being outsourced. And fourth would be this idea that the United States should launch a world democratic revolution, or what Norman Podhoretz calls World War IV, to use American military power and wealth to attempt to democratize nations all over the world, but especially in the Arab and Islamic world. I think many conservatives are taking a second look at this policy. Well, I was one of the few to oppose war as a conservative. There were others like Robert Novak and Doug Bandow. Now we see George Will and William F. Buckley and Tucker Carlson and Henry Hyde and others expressing skepticism about the whole idea of war cum nation building. And so I think that is another issue on which the Republican Party will be divided, foreign policy.
Okay, so you're predicting a civil war within the Republican Party, and you just mentioned the names of a few prominent conservatives who agree with you on some of these issues. But a few people doesn't amount to a civil war. How divided do you think the party really is right now?
Well, let me interrupt you there. Let's take the issue of immigration. A majority of the country is opposed to open borders immigration. A majority of the country wants illegal immigration halted cold. A majority want illegal aliens sent back to the countries they came from. This is true at the grassroots of the Republican Party. And so I think that is now a majority position. A majority of the country now believes Iraq was a mistake, and they agree with us. It may not be true inside the Republican Party, but there's a growing minority. On the issue of jobs and manufacturing, when the president's head of his Council of Economic Advisors said outsourcing is good for America, he was forced to back down from that statement by members of the Congress of the United States led by the Speaker. So on all of these issues, what you have is either powerful minorities inside the Republican Party or a clear majority. So I think the president is being supported because he is president, because Republicans are loyal to their leader and to their president, because this is a close election, and because George Bush is infinitely preferable to John Kerry. But I would not take that for full assent to all of the Bush policies. Across the Republican spectrum, there is an enormous amount of grumbling and dissent about where the president has been leading the country.
Now, do you think that some of the people who share your opinion don't want to say so publicly because it would sound divisive?
Of course, that's correct. I think the president's going to get the support, probably, I've seen some polls, of 97% of conservatives and Republicans because of the apprehension that if he does not get those votes, then the presidency will go to John Kerry, whom they believe is correctly is a Massachusetts liberal with almost a 100% liberal voting record. And who whose performance when he came back from Vietnam they truly abhor. So they're standing behind the president now, and frankly, inside the Democratic Party. There are many Dean supporters who are backing John Kerry, who probably are grinding their teeth as he says that he will win this war. So I think inside both parties, the coalitions who are standing behind their man in this election do not necessarily agree with their man in this election.
Do you consider yourself a Republican now? I mean, you ran on the reform ticket.
Well, I would consider myself an independent conservative who clearly is leaning to President Bush for the reason that I think the president has been very good on the issues of taxes, on conservative judges, on values, and on the defense of America's sovereignty with his opposition to the Kyoto Protocol and the International Criminal Court. But where the president agrees with Kerry, which is on trade, on immigration policy, on Iraq, and on other policies, I disagree with the president.
Now, you've become a forceful opponent of the war in Iraq and a forceful critic of President Bush on how he's conducted that war and his reasons for starting that war. And in that sense, are you finding that you're on the same team as a lot of people who you always oppose, i.e. Democrats?
I think that's very true. Most of the opposition to the war in Iraq probably came from the liberal wing of the Democratic Party, although there was a significant contingent of conservative writers. And I've already mentioned Robert Novak and Pat Buchanan and Sam Francis and Joe Sobran and Paul Craig Roberts and Charlie Reese and others, whose columns appear regularly in Conservative Chronicle, who also oppose the war. There is a significant movement inside the Republican Party to return to an America First foreign policy, which fundamentally would argue that the United States ought not to go to war unless our interests or our citizens are threatened or imperiled, and that we ought not to fight other countries' wars, and we assuredly ought not to go abroad in search of monsters to destroy and develop our own Pax Americana or American Empire, which is the objective of the group known as the neoconservatives. And this is the battle line inside the Republican Party.
Now, I'm interested in another issue about how you decided who to vote for, and it sounds like you're voting for President Bush. You said on the one hand you oppose the war in Iraq and how the president has conducted it. You also oppose his spending policies, including the war, which have led to record deficits. In the positive side, you support Bush on values, on his judicial selections, on his opposition to joining the International Criminal Court. You feel so strongly about the war and so strongly about the deficit. Why have values and judicial appointments won over Bush's conduct over the budget and the war?
Well, as I've told folks, I disagree with the president on foreign and fiscal policy and on immigration and trade policy. But other than that, he's been a real good president. And they say, what else is there? And there are other things, as you have mentioned and I have mentioned. There's taxes, there's judges, there's values, and there's sovereignty. And I do not know why it, in my judgment, it is a non sequitur to say that because I disagree with the president so vehemently on a war that he started and John Kerry voted for, I should therefore support John Kerry, with whom I disagree on everything. Secondly, as I mentioned, I believe a civil war is going to break out inside the Republican Party. And if one wants to play a role in that conflict, I think you have to be there. You cannot be AWOL when the great and decisive battle for the presidency is engaged on November 2nd.
I think John Kerry would say he didn't vote for the war. He voted for to authorize the president to lead us into war if it became necessary.
Well, in my judgment, Madison gave the Congress the power to declare war for a reason. He did not want the commander-in-chief, who would have to fight the war, the president, to also be deciding whether we went to war. That's one of the reasons we rejected the King of England. And so I think what Mr. Kerry did, and what many of those Democrats who do not believe or did not really believe in this war did, was they abdicated their constitutional responsibility to demand that the President of the United States make a far better case for war than he had made. And they did it in the fall of 2002. And I admire some of the Democrats who stood up in that patriotic moment and said, no, the case hasn't been made. And even though it may affect our party in this election, we're not going to vote that authority as of now.
My guest is Patrick Buchanan. His new book is called How the Right Went Wrong. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Pat Buchanan is my guest. He has a new book called Where the Right Went Wrong. This presidential race is so close now, a lot of people are wondering if it's going to go to the courts again, you know, if the election will end up in the courts, which leads me to 2000, when you ran on the Reform Party ticket for president. And some people think that your presence on the ballot in Florida helped to decide the race in one of two ways. One is that you got over 3,400 votes. So if those votes, if you weren't on the ticket and those votes were divided between Gore and Bush, one of them might have had a decisive victory in Florida. And well, other possibility is, and this is the other other thing, is that, you know, the butterfly ballot in Palm Beach County, some people say it was so confusing. In fact, there was a lawsuit that said that people inadvertently, mistakenly voted for you when they meant to vote for somebody else because the ballot was so confusing. And it was assumed that that many of the people who voted for you, if they in fact intended to vote for somebody else, that somebody else would have been Gore. So that's another way that your presence on the ballot might have been a decisive factor in the Florida elections. Have you been thinking about that much, and do you give credence to any of that?
Oh, yeah. I think that the butterfly ballot was not my idea, but the very fact that the butterfly ballot was there, and I not only got, I think, some 3,000 votes in Palm Beach County alone, but there were, I think, 10 or 11,000 spoiled ballots where the voters voted for both Buchanan and Gore. Of the latter votes, I think probably 95% of them were Al Gore's. And probably of the 3,000 or so, I would guess 75% of them were Al Gore's. So it is clear that if you took Palm Beach County alone, I think I denied my presence on the ballot, or the fact that there was a butterfly ballot and that second hole in the butterfly ballot was beside my name and not Al Gore's, and folks did not recognize that. That cost Al Gore the state of Florida. But on the other hand, in four states, I believe it was Minnesota, Iowa, New Mexico, and Oregon, my votes alone would have given George Bush victory in all four states. So if I hadn't been on the ballot, I don't know the exact outcome where those votes would have gone, because the president came within a fraction of 1% in those four states, and I got over that fraction of 1%.
I'm going to take you back to something I know you've been asked about a lot, and it's your now famous statement about the culture wars at the 1992 convention, in which you said that there was a religious war and a cultural war underway for the soul of the country, and you said that Clinton was on the other side with an agenda of radical feminism, abortion, abortion on demand and homosexual rights. Now, a lot of political analysts said that your comments helped George Bush lose that election. Do you see it that way?
No, neither does Bill Clinton. In his memoirs, he writes that he thought my approach and my attack along that avenue was probably the best course that the Republicans could take because Mr. Bush's record on the economy was so dismal that Carville was telling one and all, it's the economy, stupid. We've got to stay focused on the economy. And I wanted to get the president off the economy onto the social, cultural, and moral issues where Clinton was extraordinarily vulnerable, where 70% of the country agreed with President Bush, not Bill Clinton. But the Republican Party was panicked, I think, by the counterattack from Clinton and the national media when we raised these issues. But the truth is, there is a cultural war going on in this country, and it is at root a religious war, as we now know from the division of the nation into red and blue states. And we learn that the major point on which people agree and disagree between the red and blue states is if you go to church once a week or more, you vote Republican, and if you go to church once a month or less, or you're an agnostic or an atheist, you will vote almost 2-1 Democratic. So I think religion is at the core of the cultural war in this country, and the cultural war is what is dividing America into red and blue states.
Let me ask you a question, though, about that expression, culture war. You could argue that it's one thing to say there are many divisions in America between Republicans and Democrats, and between people who support gay rights and people who don't. But once you put it in terms of culture wars, then it makes it sound like people are in America are having some kind of civil war. And whichever side you're on, it's a war, and it's your job to win. And, you know, when you're at war, you use every tactic that you can to vanquish your opponent. And so you can argue that language like culture wars creates a nastier climate in the United States, a climate not of acceptance, but of like battling with other people so that you can win for your side's values.
Well, let's take the issue of right to life. To people who believe that every life is sacred and that an unborn child is a human being at the moment of conception, we are talking about the mass slaughter of over 40 million unborn children since Roe v. Wade. Now, I think that's a far more serious matter than whether someone describes the conflict over an issue like that as a culture comp, a cultural struggle, a culture war. And as I say, scholars and academicians and journalists now use the term routinely. And it's an accurate depiction of what's going on. So I think it'd be a terrible mistake for us to really circumscribe our language and submit to the dictates of political correctness rather than tell the truth.
Let me mention some other issues that the cultural wars are used to describe, and that would include gay rights, religion versus being secular. I mean, do you think that there should be a war against secularism or a war against homosexuality?
Well, there's a war against Christianity going on in America. I mean, it is the drive by militant secularists to expunge all representations, symbols of Christianity from public schools. Why is there no right to even, many of us grew up, there was the Lord's Prayer in public schools, there were Christmas carols, there were Easter pageants. All of this has been expunged.
So what some people would interpret as interpretations of the separation of church and state, you see as attacks against Christians?
No, I think these things should be decided democratically. In other words, if a school in lower Manhattan decided it didn't want an Easter pageant because many of its most of its students were secular and Jewish, I have no problem with that as long as it's made democratically. The problem with our society is that the Supreme Court has established itself as a dictatorship. And we wait for the fall and for October to hear the word from on high about how we may be able to govern ourselves. And when 70, 80, and 90% of the people want voluntary prayer in the public schools and voluntary Bible reading, and the court says you can't have it, that to me is a dictatorship. We have no recourse. You cannot fire them. You cannot throw them out of office. They serve for life. They're anointed, and they do as they please. And what they have done is hijacked the Constitution and used it to impose their views and values on what used to be a democratic republic.
My guest is political analyst Patrick Buchanan. His new book is called How the Right Went Wrong. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Patrick Buchanan. His new book is called How the Right Went Wrong. When we left off, we were talking about the culture wars. On the issue of gay rights and gay marriage, your position is?
My position is this. I do agree with the point that this ought to be decided. Marriage is an issue that should be left to the states. But once again, it should be left to the representatives of the people, legislators and executives. My objection to what happened in Massachusetts is two. First, this judge, Justice Margaret Marshall, simply declared that there was in the Massachusetts Constitution the right of homosexuals to marry, which is preposterous. And if I were Governor Romney, I would have ignored her court order and said, I read the Constitution too, and I'm sworn to uphold it. And there's no such thing in the Constitution, and I'm not going to obey your order. Now, do what you wish, but the legislature and I are not passing the legislation you demand. And that would have reestablished the authority, the superior authority of elected leaders over unelected judges. Secondly, my concern about Massachusetts is that under the full faith and credit clause of the Constitution, gay couples are now leaving Massachusetts after having been married there, so to speak, and going to other states and demanding that these, quote, marriages, unquote, be recognized, and the Supreme Court is going to make the final decision there. So in that case, I have recommended, and the Congress in the House is pursuing, legislation which would strip the U.S. Supreme Court and all federal courts of any jurisdiction over the issue of marriage. And I think that would be a good thing. Under Article 3, the Congress has the power to restrict the jurisdiction of the U.S. Supreme Court, and it's an unused power in the that still lies there in the Constitution, and I'm hoping to see it applied.
Is the bottom line for you that you just oppose homosexuality?
Well, I just think it's unnatural and immoral and wrong, and I think it's ruinous to body, soul, and nation alike, especially if it's pandemic. I think it was probably, even though folks won't say it, it's probably the position of the great majority of Americans.
Do you really think so? I mean, let me ask you, like, Dick Cheney's daughter is a lesbian. Newt Gingrich's sister is a lesbian. There are so many people in America who have either a lesbian or a gay person in their family. I'm not even counting people who are lesbian or gay, but they have somebody who's lesbian or gay in their family, their next-door neighbor, their associate at work, their friend, their cousin, etc. I mean, don't you think that that's kind of changing a lot of opinions?
Well, in terms of how people should be treated, I mean, I think people should be treated with respect. And, I'm not for gay bashing of any kind, but I do think that so-called lifestyle is not moral and it's not right. And I think ultimately it's going to be destructive of society. I think with regard to homosexuality, I think it's unnatural and wrong. And I will say this, my guess is, and I don't speak for these individuals, but if the parents of a lovely gal who comes to them and announces that she's a lesbian, their heart probably sinks when they hear the news, because it's very much in human nature that this is not natural.
Okay, well, you are very, very clear on your position on that. I have a question for you that I think has nothing to do with presidential politics, and that is this. You were a guest on the Ali G Show.
Right.
I need to know, did you know the show before you went on? And Ali G, it's a persona of a comic. It's a show that started in England and now airs here on HBO. It's very funny, and he's in the kind of persona of a young hip-hop kind of guy who interviews people in power and always asks the most intentionally ludicrous question. So what did they tell you in advance?
Well, you sent a formal letter, and it looked like a perfectly legitimate letter, and it said it was doing a program that was aimed at 18 to 24 year old, and it was to educate them in England on the on American politics and culture, and I was being asked as one of those who would comment on American politics and the workings of the American system in the time of a presidential election. I said, come on over. And they came on over. They did not indicate who the host would be. And when they set up in my living room, are in my den. I was told that the host was a rap singer and that he had excellent rapport with the young people of England. And so I said, fine, I've done all manner of shows and Jon Stewart and other shows. So I said, fine, I'll do my best. And so when he came in, and but I knew there was it was a spoof in the sense that he was much brighter than he was behaving. When I would make some comments, which were sort of, I thought, ironic, and he would smile, and you knew he was picking up on it. And so he was putting on a bit of an act. And so I went along with the whole program. And when he said, did Saddam had any BLTs? And I said, no BLTs and no mustard. So I went along with it. I thought I'd just, you know, play it straight. And I told my wife, that fellow knows a lot more than he's putting on.
So there was a turning point where you figured out it was a spoof.
Oh, sure. I mean, because it was fairly early because he was very bright.
Uh-huh. You glad you did it?
Oh, sure. I mean, I've never gotten so much comment on a show I've done. I can remember I was walking to the Madison Square Garden convention, and people yelling, you were great on the Ali G show.
Patrick Buchanan, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Patrick Buchanan's new book is called How the Right Went Wrong.